why there are different stories in different places, I think, has a lot to do with the local environment, with the fact that you share your stories not just among people, but you share them with the world around you, and that shapes the stories that you tell. And I think you were talking, when you first spoke, you talked about how people of all these different language groups had similar stories. And do you think it might be possible that it's not just communication between people, but the fact of all being in the same land is what led to those led to the similarities of the stories, that the things around, the non-human storytellers and forces that influence our stories, all had similar things to say to those people, being from the same places. And so the stories formed separately, but similarly, because there were similar contributors. They just weren't human contributors. And so I wanted to add that in as far as like a possibility of how to think about story and land
sure.
and place, as that it's not just people that tell stories and that have a say in the stories, but all the things around us. And so on that note, I'm curious what sort of stories people discovered or found, if anything, or just bits of stories or just senses of things, and if anyone has anything to share.
I'll jump in.
Yeah.
I've always had a very deep for poplar trees and apples.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, I chose apples. And so it's been like a continuing relationship that I have with trees over my whole life. But, you know, having a little bit of dedicated time, like I walked over to where there were dead aspen trees and there were live aspen trees, and I was, you know, like touching them and thinking, you know, well, there was life force from the dead aspen tree, just like there was from the life force that was coming from the live aspen,
mm-hmm.
and which, you know, I never really even observed before.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it just got me, I mean, I've written a little bit about aspens, and they're kind of like a family to me, you know, and the way their organism is shapes people. And I think that's a really good example of, you know, there are a lot of aspens and cottonwoods in Montana, and they've shaped what we are in Montana,
yeah.
for sure,
right?
And in the other places where they are. So I don't know if that was really a developed story, but it was, I appreciated the time to think about the dead and live aspens.
Yeah, that is, I think that there is the inkling of a story there of those aspens talking about how life and death relates to them, and that says something to us too, and could shape our relationship to death, and to like, yeah, that's a lesson from the aspen. Thank you. Anyone else?
This is not so much Florida, but I'll just drop a little anecdote. I had come around the aspen grove from the other side, and I was there, you know, visiting with one of the aspen trees. Well, I'm pretty sure it was you. All of a sudden, like, I was just so startled to see you there. So engrossed in the tree that all of a sudden this other human presence was like, what the? Where did you come from? So I knew the 15 of us had all come together 5 minutes ago doing this thing. Right? I was just
yeah, and I saw you looking at the tree, and I'm like marveling at the bark.
Yeah.
Like, and like, I was looking also. So yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Like even like I knew that you had been there as I approached, but somehow you just dropped out of my little awareness all together in those 3 or 4 minutes.
That's a talent.
Yeah, and so this was my object, and my brain went into straight illustration mode, where this thing all of a sudden became a creature. So it was like the top of an animal, like the, thinking like a cockatiel or that little crazy feather. And then it was like, no, I don't want to be that. I want to be a tail feather. And then it became the tail feather.
Yeah.
And then it's like, I want to ride, ride the wind. And then it decided like, hey, I want to have a little more, maybe I should put some moss on it so I can have a little spin and get farther up. And so I kept choosing to, and then I found myself over by the little cabin, and the grasses were getting higher. And all of a sudden, like, I stopped like this, and then now I'm a crouching tiger. So I go and I start giggling at myself. I'm like, no, I'm just going to stay with it. This is a fun little story. So this whole thing sort of took on life of its own, but then became sort of an extension because I found my posturing and my body kind of doing the things that I was thinking, like, oh, I'm going through the grass. Very fun.
Yeah, you're able to become the sort of different sorts of things, and a story of wanting to change, a story of wanting to be different things, and of playing, and of, yeah, I mean, there's a lot there, I think, that... Yeah, definitely, like, because that leads to the sort of follow-up question. I mean, I still want to open it up for any of the stories after I say this, too, but just that, what did, I mean, the goal, I think, of trying to find these stories isn't just to discover a narrative that involves non-human things, but to reflect on how looking for that story and paying attention and trying to pay and to engage with relationally with the things around us, rather than just pretending we know exactly what they are or want, but engaging relationally with our bodies, like engaging like you did, like just getting really into it, how that affects the way we feel towards the things around us, how that affects how we might be predisposed to treat those things. I think that, and if anyone has any thoughts on that.
I had this leaf, and right when you started talking, all of a sudden I just realized that it had, I had to animate it and make it into a puppet and talk, and it became this pretty arduous project to try and listen to everything you said and keep the mouth and to someone else. And I've done a little bit of puppeteering in my life. One of those roads that I didn't quite travel on. But I really like the idea of an inanimate object is using our sense of play to animate it and make it into a character.
Gate.
Yeah, I had this this stick which I found on the ground near some aspens, and one thing I noticed about it was how one side is like it was light, and the other side has this black patches, and I didn't know what had caused the stick to die or fall off the tree, or whether it was part of a dead tree before, but I felt that the stick had some, like, what I felt from it was, I am a message that tells of what happened. Like, I can show, I can mark, and I can show why I have fallen. I am lying here, even though I am no longer a part of what I was, I am lying here on the ground to tell of what happened. That if this is a fungus or something that caused the tree to die and fall, that this stick is dutifully carrying a message of what happened, and for a while, and then it will dissolve, and then it will become other things, and will be broken down, and will carry further messages in other forms. But that right now, for a time, it's telling the story of what happened to the tree it was a part of. And it has moved from that tree, and it is telling that story to the ground, and it's telling that story to me passing by it. But that it has a tale to tell that's inscribed on it. And I got the feeling, like, talking about, like, animating and applying that emotion and relationship and not distinguishing between projection and observation, the feeling that it felt like this is like a young stick that was like gone out as like a responsibility, like a messenger, as like I'm going to like I have a responsibility to tell what happened. Like, I am going to leave my homeland and tell the story of my people, even if it's people is the other branches on the same tree. And it just felt very like So maybe it's happy that I'm bringing it with me, because I can spread that message further. Yeah, and so that's the feeling, the story I got from this stick. Yeah.
I had one probably involved in this now. I was looking at a leaf on the cottonwood tree and tracing the line of the distribution of chlorophyll and water.
Mm.
Wow.
Cool.
Yeah, the whole world of plant life sinks.
I don't think that brings too much knowledge at all. That's beautiful. Yeah.
Also, and, too, those are veins and arteries.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. And there are animate life things out of those, too.
Exactly.
Mm.
Yeah. Hmm.
Well, I know one of the things was if like kind of cultivating story, things that we could maybe try and do if we find story to be important and maybe something that's lacking in a way that we wouldn't like, what are things that we could do to encourage? Yeah, I mean, that's a great example. And are there other ones that maybe anyone can think of that might help kind of instill this particular way of relating with the world?
I think one step that's really important is just to recognize how inescapable story is, to recognize that everything that pretends to be explanation or pretends to be information is telling a story, just in the sense that it is affecting the way that you see the world. And so it's affecting the way that you relate to the world. And so being conscious of that and paying attention and taking opportunities to, if you feel uncomfortable with the story that is being that you are absorbing, to try to seek alternative stories, to try to seek other ways of framing information to help with those stories. And I mean, David and I chatted a little bit in between a couple of the stops just about how you were telling me about what were essentially native boarding schools, but for Saxon children in Europe. That this is a global practice of trying to kill culture, trying to kill alternative stories, because whoever controls the story that masquerades as explanation controls the world, controls people. And so story is a really powerful kind of magic, and that's not a metaphor. It's magic in the sense that it's a form of mind control, and it's a form of it's a form of control. A really powerful and potent form of control. And the most dangerous thing to a dominant story is an alternative story. Because that can break away from the ways that we're used to thinking about things. And so I think that, like, yeah, just what we were doing today and just trying to seek out other stories and just being open to... And I also think that what you said earlier about having multiple stories, not one story, is key too. About just, like, not being able to hold many truths, having like a more subtle notion of truth than that there is one truth and everything else is false, but being able to say things that seem to contradict but are actually both true in different levels of depth and in different relational ways, and being able to hold multiple truths like that together, I think that's really powerful. Because you can always have a different way of thinking about things that frees you from certain traps. Like cultural and yeah, I don't know. Those are my thoughts, at least. On that might not be as concrete, though. I mean, because practices are important too, just of attention and of. But yeah.
I have an anecdote to share. It's not related to nature, so much. There's a group that I work with, and we bring a lot of veterans into town, and we usually run through Weber, who's one of the teachers, the vocational teacher at Capitol High, works with this group too. So we have the vets go down and talk to the kids. And we had this one guy in, he's a Navy SEAL, and you know, the stereotype of the SEAL, this guy has been places and done things that most of us don't even want to think about. And in the Q&A period, one of the kids asked him, what do you think is the most dangerous thing our country faces today? And his response was confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. And it's an inability to look at other perspectives and understand things in different ways.
Being so stuck in one story that when another story is screaming out to you, you can't hear it.
And
yeah.
It wasn't the answer the kid was expecting.
Yeah.
He had to explain what confirmation bias was.
Well, I'm glad you explained it to me.
Well, here's maybe sort of on that note, but you were looking for practice. And I mean, it's even coming up. We naturally converse like this, or the language naturally puts this in this. Well, it's either X or not X. It's either A or B.
Yes.
It's always a binary.
Yes, that's right.
Binary.
Mm-hmm. That's
you know,
right.
Every morning, or every whenever, you know, sit down with the newspaper, sit down with whatever, and just find five times where that kind of assumption gets made. Well, it's not this, then it's that.
Yeah.
And ask, all right, what's a third option?
Right.
Sit with it until you find one, and then go on to the other four. Right?
Yeah.
And just do that five times
that's
a day.
That's beautiful.
It
love
will
that.
Be, and the more you get used to it, you'll start not just getting a third, but a 7th and a 23rd.
Yeah.
Right. Mm. It will explode those binaries.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so not even thinking, like, what's the middle? What's off in a totally different direction from this? What's putting a second or third axis on this?
Yeah, I mean, that should be a skill that every child is taught.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
From an early age.
It really shouldn't get them passed off to be afraid without being down.
I also, I think another one is, you know, I talked a bit about the difference between speaking about and speaking to and with. And so I think that, like, cultivating ways of talking that acknowledge, because when you speak about things, it's the way that David Abram puts it is you double the world. You create a secondary world that represents the world. So you have trees, but then you have the word tree. And when you split your way of discourse so much, you can get lost in this sort of cycle of just talking about words and representation. But when you include, when you drop into the body and include the world in your speech and sort of are, and recognize like the physicality of speaking, that you are carving air, that you are participating in something, that you are always relating, that you can't stand apart from things, just being attentive to speech, to language, is, I think, something that inherently also cultivates a sort of a storytelling sensibility in a way, or a way of like engaging with different stories and the storytelling as crafted language and as speaking with things and sympathizing and oh, yeah.
It's the kind of thing I do with Latin. So, you know, I hear a word, you cast it with Latin,
No, that's absolutely true. Yeah, thinking about prepositions as really framing our relationship and thinking about how because speaking about, where does that put you? That puts you away from the thing. That explicitly about puts you away from something.
You're around it. You're looking at it.
Yeah, you're looking at it from outside.
Yes.
With is dialogue. With is adjoining. You might be like, I felt that the stick was trying to talk about
its relationship to the tree and all this sorts of stuff. Like, in that sense, yeah, in a way it's similar, it sounds similar to talking about, but I'm speaking with, like, the sticks next to me. I'm like, oh, like, we feel this way is kind of how, and even if the language sounds the same, the function the language is performing is very different, because it's like we're standing next to each other, and I'm talking, and then through, when I spoke as the stick, when I said it's saying I, and then it's speaking through me, and that puts me in a different relationship of it joining with me and changing me, and me expressing that, speaking to dialogue. That's important. Speaking to the things, like, what are you trying to tell me? What is it that is important? Ah, I see. Oh, I see these things. Oh, interesting. Wow. And look at the, like, and those are three ways of relating that don't take you out and pretend that you are completely different and that you can contain this thing entirely. So again, like, that is a good way to sort of just spend a little more time with those words and think about how each way of speaking, with, to, and through, where that places you and how differently engaging that is.
Right.
What's that?
A lot of, like, the kids I work with have a strong inability to use those prepositions, and I was just wondering, is it not part of the language, or from where, way back?
There was prepositions are not big in Indigenous language.
Well, and I tell you, sometimes I don't even think they hear them, to really overemphasize to, say to the story.
Yeah, exactly. Crow is like that too.
Wow.
What is Crow?
The Crow language. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Huh.